Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Juneteenth is now a federal holiday commemorating the end of slavery in the U.S. But Juneteenth isn't the only holiday that recognizes the legal end of slavery in the Americas. August 1st is Emancipation Day in many English-speaking countries in the Caribbean. Today, Where We Live, we talk about this history. Our state has a sizable population of people of West Indian descent. Is your family from the West Indies? Is Emancipation Day a holiday your family talks about? If you're a member of the West Indian community in Connecticut, we want to hear from you. What's your family story? You can join us, 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WMPR. You can share a comment on our Facebook page and find us on Twitter at Where We Live. Now, some of the show topics you hear on Where We Live come from our listeners, and you can always pitch an idea by emailing me, lucy@ctpublic.org. My first guest pitched today's show, and I'm happy to welcome Sandra Tate Eady. She's on Zoom with us. She's a family historian, a certified teacher, and an independent historical researcher, and she's a Connecticut resident, originally from Barbados. Sandra, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning, Lucy. Thanks, Connecticut Public Television, for having me this morning.
And with us as well is Fiona Vernal, Associate Professor of History and Africana Studies at UConn, and she's Jamaican-American. Fiona, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Lucy. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Your colleague, Dexter Gabriel, is also with us. He's Assistant Professor of History and Africana Studies at UConn. And Dexter, you have a connection as well. Where's your family from?
Hello, Lucy. Thank you for having me. Yeah, my family's from Trinidad and Tobago.
Well, this should be a really interesting hour talking about the West Indians living in our state. And it goes back for some time. So, Sandra, I'll start with you. I mentioned your family is from Barbados. Tell us about the history of your family story and how you ended up in Connecticut.
So, Tess, I'm actually from Barbados also. I was born, I came to Connecticut at the age of 12. And when I came to Connecticut, there was no, are you hearing me okay?
Yes, Sandra, go ahead.
Yes. So I came to Connecticut at the age of 12 from Barbados as an immigrant and attended Kennelly Elementary School. And we lived in the south end of Hartford. There were hardly any other West Indian children in the area. And so for a long time, I didn't feel seen. And then at my school, being born in a British colony and being cultivated in a independence mindset, I fully knew myself as Barbadian. And growing up in a majority culture, I was pretty solid in my identity. And that all changed when I moved here. And so I always looked for Barbados in everything that I did. And the first time I saw it, actually, Lucy, was one of our required readings was The Witch of Blackbird Pond. And that was the first time I made a connection for myself. While everybody saw me as Black, I saw myself as Barbadian. So anytime I saw Barbados, it meant a lot to me. And so I think I also came at a very historic time in America. It was 1975. My first year at school was 1976. And as you know, that was the American Bicentennial. And so I got all wrapped up in the festivities for that at my school. However, you know, another year later, Roots comes on TV, and then I go, okay, what is this all about? So I think that there's some very specific events that got me interested in learning more. And when my identity was challenged, it kind of made me want to know more about, you know, where I came from and who we are and, you know, why people see me as a color and not as I saw myself at that time as a Barbadian. And then why did roots resonate so much with me? Because I had no idea about our past and our history. So one thing led to the next, and my interest in history just kept growing. And that brought me to today, asking you if you would please engage with this topic and just with our history in general. Yes.
When you talk about the history of Barbados, talk a little bit about Barbados and its relationship with the British Empire.
So really good question. So Barbados was thought to be uninhabited when the British came, according to that historical record. And so the British Empire claimed Barbados as a colony with the intention of growing raw materials, tobacco, cotton, and they tried that at first in around 1625. And that wasn't as successful as sugar. Once sugar was introduced, and it was believed it was introduced by Brazilians, sugar just turned out to be a perfect crop for our climate. And so the British colonists embarked on the production of sugar. And they immediately, now England was late to the game of the transatlantic slave trade. Mm-hmm. They had not been engaged, but once sugar became successful, they saw the opportunity to expand sugar using the labor of enslaved Africans. And so Barbados evolved as a commercial enterprise with sugar being very prosperous and made England, English planters very wealthy. And that continued for a very long time. Barbados remained the only island to be under British rule for the entire time of its existence, up to 1966 when the island became independent. So we have I was born a British subject, if you will, but 3 years later we gained independence, and from then on I was cultivated in a very nationalistic mindset. Mm-hmm.
You know, earlier I mentioned that we have many residents that are of West Indian descent. Fiona, you're Jamaican American. So when we talk about why West Indians came to our state, you know, I live up in Suffield. There are still many farms. And in the summers, there are farm workers of generations from Jamaica that still come up here.
Absolutely. Yesterday, I was in Enfield, right next door at the Emancipation Day celebrations. There they bust in over 300 farm workers who are here to help with the tobacco crop, and that is the origin of West Indians here. They first started coming in 1943 when, under British rule, the Jamaican government negotiated with the U.S. government to help to fulfill the labor shortages after World War II. So that those are the origins, and I'm happy to elaborate.
Well, tell me about your family story, Fiona.
I came here in 1986. I'm a beneficiary of IRCA, the Immigration Reform and Control Act. So I tell everyone that I give thanks to Ronald Reagan and family reunification for getting me here. And my family came to New Jersey and I stayed there through college. And my Connecticut story is that I came to Connecticut to go to grad school at Yale, and other than one little tiny diversion to Michigan, where I discovered lake effect snow, I came right back, and here I am.
Well, we're glad to have you. When we think about the West Indian community, I think about the Hartford area, Bloomfield, Windsor. So how many people of West Indian descent live in our state, Fiona?
So we have over 80,000 of West Indian descent, but the majority of the population lives in the Greater Hartford region. There are over 36,000 Jamaicans here specifically, and we've been making gains in the census. So since 2010, Jamaicans are the largest foreign-born population in the state, and I don't think a lot of people know that, because Jamaicans have only been around Since the 1940s, there were only under 300 folks here in the 1950s, or at least that the census could count. And now West Indians are the largest foreign-born population, and we're growing. And it's exactly this early program that brought West Indians here that served that process of chain migration as folks came season after season and found Connecticut really attractive, right? Most of the time when we think about West Indians, we think about New York, or we think about Florida, but there's something particular about Connecticut that a lot of folks that I've interviewed have said is that Connecticut reminds them of home. It's small. For a long time, it was rural. There was a lot of land, a lot of space. And in terms of the kind of home ownership dreams folks had and the kind of backyards they wanted, a lot of people found Connecticut really attractive for that reason.
You're hearing Fiona Vernal here on Where We Live, Associate Professor of History and Africana Studies at UConn, as well as Sandra Tate Eady. She's a historian, a Caribbean American. As we talk about West Indian history in the context of August 1st, Emancipation Day, in many English-speaking countries in the Caribbean, if you're of West Indian descent, we'd love to hear from you as well. 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WMPR. Or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. And so, Sandra, when you pitched us this show, you know, there's so much attention on Juneteenth, and many Americans understand what this day is, and now that it's a federal holiday. But talk a little bit about Emancipation Day and why you feel it's necessary that people need to know about this as well.
Yes. So thank you for saying that. I think in general, we need to appreciate our differences and embrace our similarities. And to me, Juneteenth and West Indian emancipation, there are a lot of similarities there. We come from a very similar experience. And if we are aware of these experiences, then we can have better communication. We can have, you know, more unified discussions and interactions. So Emancipation Day in the Caribbean was spurred by the British Empire. They looked at all their possessions, which at the time in 1833 were slave empires, slave colonies. And the British government decided to end slavery in its possessions in 1833 with the Slavery Abolition Act. And that would go into effect August 1st, 1834. But alas, it wasn't quite freedom. What it basically did in the colonies was to free children ages 6 and under 6 years old. But the adults then were asked to remain in a condition called the apprenticeship or the apprentice period for an additional 4 years for their full freedom in 1838, August 1st. And so in 1834, emancipation was basically, you know, not something that the planters embraced, because let's be clear, the powers that be were not at all wanting to release their enslaved labor. It was the power of the British government that made that happen. And so the planters were in the islands were not at all, you know, happy about it. So there was no celebration in 1834. In fact, the enslaved also had a subdued attitude about it because they realized this isn't really freedom. We don't have control over our time. The planters basically gave them a quarter of their time back, kept three quarters of it, and informed them that in order to remain on the plantation, you had to give that three quarters of your time to the plantation. So there, you know, Barbados in particular being so small, well, people had nowhere to go. So they had no choice but to remain on during the apprenticeship period, basically living as they've always lived. So 1834 Abolition Act subdued, not really, you know, something that people felt, you know, could help them achieve their emancipation dreams. 1838 August 1st was a little different because now the planters, even though your labor still was not your own, It was full freedom. It was everybody then no longer classified legally as enslaved, even if your day-to-day living still felt like slavery. So emancipation was gradual in the Caribbean, but it was done through a legal process, unlike what happened here with the enslaved who just were not, you know, aware or informed, or if they knew, were not given their freedom when it was due. Emancipation Day then in 1838 was jubilation. It was church services, Thanksgiving, pageantry. On the part of the colonial government, the local colonial government, they would have done a parade with the militia. They would have, the people of color, the former enslaved and their descendants would have attended, you know, parties and a plantation. They would have then embraced the idea of emancipation, except that they still did not have control over their labor. In some cases, places like Jamaica, Guyana, where there's more land area, the enslaved had a better opportunity to realize the promise of emancipation. There was more land. They could farm their own produce, and they could trade that produce. Whereas in the land-starved islands like Barbados or Antigua, the smaller land area, that promise was deferred. In fact, in Barbados, emancipation ushered in a period of poverty, if you will, right? And it remained for a very long time. The wages were kept the same exact as they were during after emancipation. In Barbados, there was no increase in wages. In 1937, there was a labor rebellion to force planters then to just remove the stipulation so that people could finally achieve that promise that emancipation had offered. So we're still struggling for that today. It's a never-ending battle. I think being the economic minority, sometimes it really makes it difficult to see all those promises come to the fore.
And we'll talk more about that coming up, Sandra. I wanted to bring into the conversation Dexter Gabriel, who's also an assistant professor of history and Africana studies at UConn. Dexter, welcome to our show.
Hi, Lucy. Thank you for having me.
It's been interesting to hear Sandra talk about the history of Barbados and what was happening around emancipation and then in the years after. But I wanted you to talk a little bit more about New England's connection to the West Indies before emancipation and how this region profited from slavery.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about New England is that when I teach a lot of students are actually surprised to hear that New England had a role within slavery or the slave trade. I think our larger histories often of New England, the thoughts we often have are that of abolitionism and anti-slavery, which certainly does come later. But very early on, from the colonial era and even after, places like New England participated in the slave trade itself. I think most people are probably most aware with places such as Providence and elsewhere that directly were involved in the trade. But I suppose what's lesser known are places like Connecticut, where the trade itself is so dynamic that people begin engaging in the various support roles of the trade. And so, for instance, whenever we think of the slave trade, it was not only the shipment of human beings, but it was a larger business opportunity for many people. Who is going to build the ships for that trade? Who is going to supply the food for enslaved populations to eat in the West Indies? And you see places like Connecticut become the source for this in many ways. And so in Connecticut during the colonial era and again after, what we see is a trade that develops based around providing much of the sustenance that many of these British Caribbean colonies would need, because after all, Connecticut at the time, early on, is also a British colony. And so there's a trade there. Some of this trade is in food. Some of this trade is in cattle. You have to remember that these various colonies, particularly the island of Barbados, this becomes a key place that Connecticut ends up in trade with, the colony, is that these places were growing sugar. and using up so much land to grow sugar. In fact, they don't really have much land left over to grow their own crops and sustenance. And so a trade develops and merchants see an opportunity here for Connecticut, which has its farmland, which where it is growing food, to provide that food to these basic slave societies. And over time, as I said, this will expand to also bringing cattle to places like Barbados. And of course, as this develops, there's also reverse trade in bringing back slaves. And so what we see is that this trade that develops to provide these material goods and other things to the Caribbean also brings back enslaved people here to Connecticut and to parts of New England. And of course, Connecticut is also profiting because the other things they get in that trade, of course, are sugar's byproduct, molasses, which is very instrumental in creating rum and distilled liquors. And so we see Connecticut in many ways profiting from the trade, if not directly, also indirectly, right? Both are happening.
You're listening to Where We Live here on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're learning about West Indian history in the context of Emancipation Day, a holiday around August 1st in English-speaking Caribbean countries that commemorates the end of slavery. We know Connecticut has many residents of West Indian descent. Are you one of them? How do you or your family mark Emancipation Day? We want to hear from you. 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WMPR. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We'll be back after a short break.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. A lot of people struggle with sleep apnea and with CPAP machines. Dr. Carl Muller, a head and neck surgeon with Hartford Hospital, describes Inspire, a surgical alternative to the CPAP approach.
Only about 60% of patients can tolerate CPAP real well. Inspire is a surgical alternative to CPAP. It's an outpatient surgery. It takes about 2 hours. And essentially what it does is it picks up when you're taking a breath and sends a 2-second electrical pulse to the tongue, which causes the tongue to stick out a little bit and stiffen and prevent the airway from collapsing.
Hartford Hospital has performed more than 200 Inspire therapy surgeries. If you've tried and failed with CPAP, you could be a candidate for this minimally invasive procedure.
Patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea are candidates. There is a weight criteria, so you have to have a body mass index below 35, and you have to have tried and failed CPAP.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In-Community Speaker Series May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speakerseries. This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're learning about Emancipation Day, August 1st, marked in many English-speaking Caribbean countries. My guest today on Zoom, Sandra Tate Eady. She's a Connecticut resident, originally from Barbados, and a historian. Also with us, Fiona Vernal, Associate Professor of History and Africana Studies at UConn and Jamaican American. And Dexter Gabriel, also with the Assistant Professor of History in the same department at UConn. And Dexter, I forgot to ask, you've got a connection to the Caribbean?
Yes. Both my parents are from Trinidad and Tobago. Well, Trinidad to be specifically, but the larger republic is the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago. And like many Trinidadians, they're actually from somewhere else. Trinidad is an interesting, almost like an immigrant community for the Caribbean and elsewhere. And so on my father's side, one generation previous, we are from Karakou, a small Grenadian island. And on my mother's side, about two generations or so, there are ties to Barbados, of course, to be mentioned again, as well as St. Vincent. And so, those are my ties. And I was born in New York City, but I ended up being sent back to live in Trinidad for 6 or 7 years with my grandparents. From there, I returned to New York, where there was this very large and vibrant West Indian community and family. And then my parents picked up and moved us to Houston, Texas,
oh boy.
Where there was not a very large West Indian community, or at least one that we were aware of. I think Houston is very large and we were all spread out. And so most of my upbringing, I had a home culture that was this Caribbean culture, but my larger culture, most of my friends and everyone were African Americans, that was my larger culture. And my parents also embraced this. And so though we knew about Emancipation Day, my parents, my family, we heartily celebrated Juneteenth in Texas, of course, every year. And so I think I've always had that dual upbringing within a rich African-American tradition, while also having this Caribbean tradition. So Texas is where I grew up, where I lived most of my life. And I ended up moving back to New York when I was later as an adult. And I didn't come to Connecticut until 2016. I came here for work at UConn and met Fiona, who who introduced me to some of the very interesting Caribbean history that takes place in this state and in this city, Hartford. Mm-hmm.
We're talking about this history in the context of Emancipation Day. And Dexter, because you're a professor of history, let's talk about more in depth about the events that led up to the abolition of slavery in the British Empire, specifically the sustained resistance by enslaved people in places like Barbados and Jamaica.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's always interesting because certainly, Emancipation Day to Britain is remembered with this sense of pride, but the history is a lot more complicated. Britain has to goes through a very lengthy process before they decide to do away with slavery. In fact, for a very long time, they think they can perhaps ameliorate slavery, perhaps make slavery "quote unquote" more humane in many ways. And it is not until it is really enslaved people in places like Barbados, in places like Guyana, especially a revolt that takes place in late 1831 into early 1832 in Jamaica, a massive slave revolt that forces in many ways Britain's hand in saying that slavery itself is untenable and we don't think we can control this and it may not be as productive. And so we see this move to end slavery. But I think, I think as we see, as we heard, as Sandra just pointed out, freedom did not mean liberty in many ways or equality. In fact, there were deliberations about what freedom should mean in these former colonies, it was made quite certain that these former colonies had to remain profitable and that profit had to result from labor. And so even in freedom, the labor of formerly enslaved people was seen as something to be controlled. And I think, when we think about abolition in many ways, I think the state of affairs that Sandra talks about that comes about in the post-emancipation period is directly related to how emancipation itself ended up coming to fruition in those colonies.
Can you talk more about the Haitian Revolution and, the events that made this very pivotal when we think about the abolition of slavery?
Yeah, I mean, the former French colony of Saint-Domingue, the one considered the most wealthy colony in the French Empire within the slave trading Atlantic, a massive slave revolt takes place there that will end up lasting 13 years, right? So this is a massive rebellion that eventually becomes a revolution that draws in other empires, the British Empire, the Spanish, and the French all vying for this. And it is not until 1804 that the Haitian revolutionaries end up defeating Napoleon Bonaparte's veteran troops to found their own republic, and they renamed this place Haiti, which they say, which they claim is a word that comes from the by then long disappeared indigenous population of the island. So it's interesting they rename it after this indigenous name. And they become the second republic in the Western Hemisphere after the United States, in some ways a sister state to the United States, and the first Black republic. And then the honor also of being the first nation to end slavery. That honor is often given to Britain, which is bizarre because Britain, of course, doesn't issue its decree until 1833. It doesn't take effect until 1804. But before this, Haiti outlawed slavery forever on its island. And so they claim that distinction.
Fiona Vernal, we know Haiti in the news today because of the serious political crisis. And we think about, you know, the factors, the way that the U.S. has dealt with Haiti over the years, and thinking about this from the time of the Haitian Revolution, these ideas of while they were free from slavery, the types of policies that have impacted Haiti and other Caribbean nations. Can you talk about that?
You know, one of the most important things that Dexter pointed out is just how important Haiti was as a symbol of freedom, and the U.S. has had a very complicated relationship with that symbolism because it does not bode well for its own enslaved population to have freedom in the heart of slavery. And so for a very long time, on the one hand, the U.S. wants to maintain its trade relationships with Haiti, wants to maintain a robust trade relationship with Haiti because it's a very wealthy sugar producing area. And yet it also wants to control what freedom means for those folks. And so this has led to several generations of interventions in Haiti. It's sort of interesting with the assassination of the president that U.S. intervention was asked for. And I'm glad that the president demurred on that, because that would have been, you know, that would have led down a very long historical road where the U.S. has not had the best of intentions for Haiti and has not necessarily supported Haiti in its economic success, and has actually done quite a bit to undermine Haiti's economic independence over the years.
Sandra Tate Eady, I wanted to bring you back into the conversation. Again, Sandra is a Connecticut resident, originally from Barbados, and she's a historian and genealogist. Sandra, talk through some of your response when we think about the events that led to the abolition of slavery in the British Empire and in the years since, the consequences and the impact on the Caribbean people.
Good question. Barbados, of course, had a revolt in 1816 that oftentimes, I'm a teacher, and oftentimes when we learn about revolts, whether it's Nat Turner or General Bussa in Barbados' case, or Sam Sharp, we often hear the word unsuccessful associated with those particular events. And so I would argue that, in fact, they are successful if, in fact, they create discomfort for the power class. So the fact that I got hung for rebelling is okay, and it's successful if it created any movement at all towards freedom for the masses. And I think that one of the things that I, as a teacher, and also going back to my days in school, I want to hear these empowering stories of rebellion that happened in Haiti and that happened in Jamaica with Sam Sharp and happened in Barbados. But I want to hear it from a more from a positive perspective in terms of how it ushered in a different attitude in the power class, the oppressors. I wanted to also go back to the issue of emancipation. I'm surprised, Dexter, and I'm happy that your family celebrated emancipation. That was not something that was in our consciousness when abolition came. The day of the actual emancipation in 1838, sure, there was some jubilee, but we might note that the British government never made Emancipation Day a holiday. And it's holidays that help to cement these events in our consciousness. And so as a result, Emancipation Day didn't become a holiday until the government became independent. And so I think that's an important fact, because Emancipation Day and Juneteenth are things that are now beginning to surface. And we ourselves are finding ourselves needing to learn more about these events to get them into our consciousness and into the consciousness of the masses.
Can I jump in? Go ahead, Fiona.
You know, one of the things that I wanted to point out, sort of in the same vein as Sandra, in terms of the unsung, you know, sort of heroes of all of these rebellions, is that, you know, we're talking about the specific day and specific holidays, but there's so many other ways in which people made space and claimed their space. And so in the ways in which they could marry, in the way that they could become a part of a Christian community, in the way that they could take control for some of the first time over what happens to their children as parents, right? Because as enslaved people, they did not have control over their marriages, over their families. And so I want to make sure that we emphasize some of the smaller ways, and not necessarily the grand rebellions and public holidays, some of the smaller ways in which people made space, took space, and claimed space as they were transitioning to freedom. They were very well aware that freedom wasn't free and that they had to fight for it, but they also fought for it in their personal space, in their religious space. And I think it's really important to underscore those victories.
Mm-hmm. Dexter, did you want to respond?
Thank you. I think what Fiona's saying is so exceptionally important. And it even speaks to this notion of how freedom is going to be celebrated and remembered. And so I should first point out to Sandra, I should first point out that when I say my family celebrated Emancipation Day, this wasn't until the mid to late 80s, because I think in many places, Emancipation Day had become abandoned in parts of the Caribbean, British Caribbean. And so it wasn't until 1985, I believe, that Trinidad officially decided to recognize Emancipation Day again. And so it wasn't until then that it was something that my family would discuss. But that also speaks to some of those tensions that occurred after emancipation happened in 1834, and especially after 1838 with the end of the apprenticeship system. How emancipation was to be celebrated became this contentious contested between the formerly enslaved and freed people and clergy and others in the colonial state who had different ideas of how that should be done. For many freed people, for example, they wanted to celebrate their emancipation. They wanted to do something performative. Some wanted to throw parties. Some wanted to have parades or what have you. The colonial state and clergy, however, wanted many enslaved people to perform this very, I should say, quietly, to have processionals from churches, right? To make certain they attended church services, because they thought that any celebration that was too performative that the free people want might spell disorder. And all they wanted to make certain of in these colonies was that order was maintained even with the end of slavery. And so this became something that we see this contest between these two forces and who's going to win out. And many, many formerly enslaved people, many free people begin finding their own ways to celebrate. Some may decide that they're going to celebrate more during the Christmas time. In places like Trinidad, enslaved people may decide to bring about ideas of emancipation and speak about freedom during Caribbean Carnival, which is a pre-Lenten celebration in February. And so we see people finding different ways to celebrate this. So it's not surprising that actually after about the 1880s, in many places in these colonies, we see Emancipation Day sort of peter out and sort of disappear, in part because the colonial state no longer sees it as advantageous to itself and beneficial. And many of the formerly enslaved and free people find different ways to celebrate this. So in many of these colonies, much as we're seeing in the United States with the rediscovery of Emancipation Days, we see a rediscovery of many of these emancipation celebrations, at least on a national level in these colonies, really not happening until the modern era, the 80s and 90s and so forth.
You're hearing Dexter Gabriel here on Where We Live, assistant professor of history and Africana studies at UConn. His colleague Fiona Vernol is also here. And Sandra Tate Eady, a Connecticut resident originally from Barbados. We'll continue talking with them after the break and learning more about the family stories in our state and how community evolved and spread throughout Connecticut. You can join us too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up tomorrow, employers want employees to come back to the office. But after 16 months of remote work, not everyone is anxious to return to cubicles and endless coffee. On the next Where We Live, we'll talk to about how employers are navigating back to work. Are you back in the office or soon will be? We want to hear from you. That conversation tomorrow. Now, we know Connecticut has a sizable West Indian population. And today we're learning about some important history about the English-speaking Caribbean with our guests, Sandra Tate Eady. Also, Fiona Vernol is here and Dexter Gabriel. They're both professors of history at UConn. Fiona, you know, earlier we were just talking about some of the history, and I wanted to learn more about the connections and how communities spread in our state when we think about the migration here.
So as we were saying earlier, West Indians were brought here to make up for the shortage of labor because of World War II. And so they first came in 1943. And despite our small state, Lucy, if you will believe it, over 8,000 West Indians descended on the region. And the Shea Tobacco Growers Association eventually were the ones who were really instrumental in making sure that that specific wartime program became a peacetime program after the war was over. And so they kept on inviting West Indian men, and it is men, not women. The program does include women now, but for many decades, it was primarily West Indian men, and they came here and they harvested shea tobacco specifically. That program is a really fundamental part of the American agricultural system, because while they focused on shea tobacco here in Connecticut, they're also picking apples, and they're also working in sugarcane, especially in Florida. And as the program grows, they're also going into nurseries and greenhouses. They're going into sod that you put down on the golf course, and it's turning into almost year-round labor. And so that is the core of the men who used to come here. Now, that program is from the 1940s, and then with the liberalization of immigration policies after 1965, that created more opportunities for other West Indian migrants to come here, as well as migrants from across the world. Mm-hmm. So from Asia, from Africa, but this was critical for the Caribbean, because that was one of the first moments in the 1960s when families are able to come and you're able to reunify West Indian families. Mm-hmm. There's a significant proportion of West Indian women who come at that time to work in domestic service. And between the men who were here in the 1940s and the women who were starting to come in the 1960s, you have a small core of a West Indian community. When you're in Suffield and Enfield, and you're thinking about settling in Connecticut, and you're thinking about settling in a big city, Hartford is it. Hartford is that big beacon for West Indians. And when they arrived here, a lot of folks had a familiarity with Hartford because there was a huge fanfare. They used to have welcome cricket games to open up the season, as well as farewell cricket games to open the season. The Council of Churches used to help to bus the men into Hartford for services, as well as various choral groups that would perform in the region. And so I call it reconnaissance. You know, these opportunities to come into Hartford to play cricket, to spend some time at the churches, to get to know the local African-American community, gave West Indians a sense of what their lives might be like if and when they settled in Hartford. And finally, one of the other important details is that there are African-Americans who are also working in Shea Tobacco, and there are lots of African-American women who are sewing the tobacco leaves together, and a lot of West Indian men met some of those African-American women, and that West Indian man and African-American woman becomes the first cohort of that West Indian American American family that began to create our growing, our burgeoning community here in the greater Hartford region and in the state.
There's so much a strong culture within the Hartford region. We think about people of West Indian descent, Fiona. Aaliyah writes that she's a U.S. citizen with Jamaican heritage. She's enjoying this history lesson on Caribbean Americans. And she says folks should check out the Taste of the Caribbean and Jerk Festival in Hartford coming up. Did you want to talk about that, Fiona? I know West Indian Social Club, an important institution.
Yes, these very same migrants, you know, were able to pool their money. And if you can imagine how significant that is in the 1940s and in the 1960s, they were able to pool their money and put down a down payment for a house over on Barber Street. It was a multi-family house, and they bought it as their first clubhouse, and they renovated it because they really wanted a space that was theirs. A lot of the West Indian men who first came, you know, they talk about going around Hartford and feeling this wonderful welcome, of course, from the officials, from the governor, from the mayor, from the farmers, from the Shea Tobacco Growers Association. But unfortunately, that welcome, you know, was not a common experience in some of the places they were socializing. So they would go into bars in Hartford, for example, to try to have a drink and relax and socialize. And sometimes the bartenders would say, you know, because they were Black, they were going to break all of the glasses that the Black people used to drink. And you can imagine only one or two of those kinds of experiences of social exclusion would lead people to want to create a space of their own. And so that was the origin of the West Indian Social Club in 1950. And then as the West Indian Islands got its independence with Jamaica, Trinidad follows, Barbados, et cetera, the idea for West Indian independence celebration set in. And from 1962, we've been having West Indian celebrations that starts off with West Indian Week and culminates in the parade. So this year it will be in Bushnell Park, and it will be on the 14th. And there's an entire week of activities at the West Indian Social Club and the Taste of Hartford, where you can come and enjoy our Jerk Festival will be on Saturday.
That all sounds lovely. Sandra, I wanted to end with you because earlier when you said you moved here, you didn't quite feel seen. How do you feel today as part of this community and as we're learning more about the history of the Caribbean? Sandra, are you there?
Thank you for that question. The work of understanding and the work of helping us to see each other is in programs like this. It is in classrooms and university courses. I think it's really important that we let the public know that we built America together. Connecticut towns like Wethersfield and Middletown and those along the river, New London. These were port cities that were built with the labor and the profits from the Caribbean slavery, which was on the backs of people like my ancestors. And I think that when we come to understand our shared history, that things may improve, but we need to do a better job, I think, in our schools and do a better job even within our own families, talking about, you know, all of our contributions and understanding that we were there too. We Caribbean people, we people of African descent were there too, and that we helped to build us.
Sandra Tate Eady, a pleasure to hear you today on our show. Thank you for your time. Also Fiona Vernal and Dexter Gabriel from the History and Africana Studies Department at UConn. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff and Maisie Carvalho. Kat Pastor is our technical producer.